We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Monica Perez, joined today by our returning guest, Jeremy Kuzmarov, the managing editor of Covert Action magazine and author of numerous books, including The Russians Are Coming Again, the first Cold War as tragedy, the second as farce. I think I have that title memorized. Well, Jeremy and I have totally different ideological bents. He thinks government's legit, and I think it's at this point totally hopeless. But we have a lot of common ground, so let's discover it. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for joining us once again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Since last time we spoke, there have been many articles that you wrote for Covert Action magazine, and I know you're also working on an expose of, if that's the right word for it, of Bill Clinton, and I wondered how that's going.
Good. Yeah, that book should be published. I believe it'll be released on December 1st. And I worked on it for many years. It's called Warmonger, How Bill Clinton Shaped the Foreign Policy Trajectory from Bush to Biden. And yeah, it looks at how a lot of the disastrous policy really emanated with Clinton, like the NATO expansion, the new Cold War. That's obviously a key chapter. And really, Clinton set that in motion. And I think the tragedy was that you had figure like Robert McNamara, who was no dub. I mean, this is the architect of the Vietnam War. He said the end of the Cold War presents an opportunity for a new peace dividend. And, you know, we can finally invest our money. Now the Cold War is over. We can invest our tax dollar, you know, rebuilding America and improving living conditions in America. But unfortunately, Clinton followed a different path, and he really pioneered, you know, the humanitarian intervention with Cold War pretext gone. You know, Clinton used the rationale, oh, we have to stop genocide, and, you know, use these fake humanitarian motives to build the support for U.S. military intervention and for, escalating the U.S. military budget when the Cold War was over. And, you know, usually they were fake genocide, like in the Balkans, it was a very complex conflict. And actually, the U.S. was siding with Croatia and Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina, who committed a lot of the atrocities in the war, the worst ethnic cleansing. And, I mean, they were Islamic fundamentalists, and the Croats were very brutal toward the Serbs. So, you know, they claim we're stopping genocide, but they're supporting really the most brutal forces. And the Serbs have been trying to keep the Yugoslav Federation together. So in that and other cases, yeah, the rhetoric is totally hollow and misleading, but they seem to get, you know, liberals on board with these military intervention. And that what we see, you know, more recently, like in the Biden Obama years, a lot of liberals supported wars in Libya or Syria on supposed humanitarian ground, and the same kind of rhetoric was used. You know, we have to go in to stop genocide and stop these massacres, but really they're on the side of horrible forces who are committing a lot of the massacres, and there's underlying agenda, you know.
I mean, that's true right now with the conflicts we're engaged in right now.
Yeah, like Ukraine. I mean, so many liberals support it. It's only Republican congressmen who are saying we're not going to endlessly fund this war that's going nowhere. And all these liberal Democrats have been waving their Ukraine flags.
I think that was a cult of personality thing. Like, they set it up so that Trump was the bad guy by not funding Ukraine. It just absolutely was like a really hollow dialectic, like of no ideological foundation, but it's just like Democrats are against Trump. So let's make Trump against Ukraine funding.
Yeah, even though Trump really was funding it pretty significantly. And then I don't know what they're saying now that they caught, you know, their dear leader Zelensky was cheering on a Nazi in the Canadian Parliament. I don't know what they have to say about that.
That was very bizarre. That was a strange episode for sure. Well, the Clinton stuff, I used to call it the Bush-Clinton continuum because that's how I saw it even back in the day. And I think it's interesting that's where the human rights industry as a front for the military-industrial complex emerged. I'm very interested in reading your book for that reason. And I have to say, this is one of our ideological divides. I have been nodding my head and being like, okay, yes, I would much rather spend money on the U.S. than on foreign entanglements, which are inherently immoral anyway. We're using the money to kill people. I would probably rather them use money for daycare here. However, I must assert that I am a hardcore libertarian, and I would much, much, much rather that our government, at least the federal government, shrunk a lot and that just the tax rates were lower, and I think more good would come out of that. I understand that's not your position and a lot of other people.
Well, I would agree that they shouldn't overspend. I mean, the money has to be spent efficiently on the program people need. So, yeah, I agree with you. You know, the taxes don't have to necessarily be that high.
I mean, they were paying doctors. I just saw a schedule which looked totally official to me that they were giving doctors or vaccine centers or whatever. The government was giving a doctor $250 for every vaccinated person. So they were taking, you know, say, I don't know how much it costs, like how much Pfizer gets, but say they got $100 a shot. So your insurance pays Pfizer $100 to get you vaccinated. And the U.S. government pays the doctor $250. I mean, that is cronyism of the highest order, but that's the kind of thing that's actually damaging. It's as bad, you know, it is not a good, it's a public bad. So
well,
they gotta watch out for that.
Yeah. I mean, I would be emphasizing, you know, yeah, if the government actually enacted programs that, I mean, certain services they provide are necessary, but I agree with you. There's so much corruption and cronyism that the money they're spending really often doesn't benefit people. And I can see why people complain about their taxes, not only the foreign wars, but...
Yeah, they're bad. I'd rather burn it. I'd rather burn it. So, but the most recent article you wrote was called The Washington Post Lifts the Veil on the CIA's Shadow War Against Russia, waged since 2014. So I read your article on this. I read the Washington Post article on it. The Washington Post article tells a lot of stuff, but it couches it in kind of apologetic terms. Can you give us just an outline of what it is that they are revealing in this article and what... Why would they would write an article like that and what you think is really going on?
Okay. Yeah, and this is a very revealing article. I mean, a lot of it was known, I think, before. There were some Ukrainian defectors who said that the CIA was... Firstly, yeah, we know that these Ukrainian special force units and commandos have been carrying out a shadow war against Russia and carrying out terrorist activity like the car bombing that killed this young journalist, Daria Dugina, who is the daughter of Vladimir Dugin. Dugin, who's a prominent...
Yeah, that was just murder. That's just murder, and that's why they deny it, because it's murder, and now
well,
it's undeniable.
It came out that the suspect was linked with Ukraine, and I think I'm pretty sure they actually admitted to it. And they, you know, there have been articles, like the New York Times had an article earlier this year that profiled some of these commando units, and they kind of bragged that they were placing bombs in police cars and police stations and sneaking into Russian territory.
I mean, that is not legal. You know what I mean?
No.
Like they act like it's some kind of legitimate thing. That Washington Post article couched it in terms, well, we have to fight fire with fire and Russia's the real terrorist and they invaded Ukraine in 2014. I mean, I assume they're talking about Crimea, which had a nearly unanimous referendum to move from post-coup Ukraine to join the Russian Federation, where they were permitted to speak their native language. I mean, it's just preposterous to think that Russia was the aggressor in 2014, and they're acting like they were so aggressive that it justifies murdering innocent women and children, putting people in danger.
Yeah, and they're targeting civilian officials, and this is the same as the Phoenix program in Vietnam, where they're targeting mayors of towns, civilian officials in government who...
And that is not allowed. Like, there is
Russian collaborators. Yeah, this is just a...
Even in a war,
program.
Even in a war, I don't think you're allowed to do that. I think that's against the Geneva Convention.
Yeah.
I mean, they shot that admiral or former admiral when he was out for
while he
run.
Was jogging. Yeah.
Yep, and the blogger, and I know other people they've murdered. I forget the guy's name, but a real, real hero sitting in a cafe. Not just that blogger. There was another one too.
Well, a lot of the officials in the Donetsk People's Republic government were murdered. The bombing of cafes. And this is just outright terrorism and murder, which they should be prosecuted. And, you know, it's clear from the Post article that the CIA is very centrally involved in this, that they've been, financing these forces, training them. The Post, the one thing, I guess it's in a way it's kind of damage control because they're trying to say, oh, well, the CIA didn't plan those terrorist acts, but they do acknowledge they're financing these forces, training them, working very closely with them. So,
and using them to gather information that they are hoovering up.
Exactly. They're helping the intelligence to identify these individuals and identify, their schedules. But
also the CIA is using their Ukrainian operatives to gather intelligence. So obviously, I mean, you could call it an arm of the CIA. You can say whatever you want about them shrugging their shoulders, or one of the quotes was, we want nothing to do with that. But if they're...
Well, they set it all up. And, right. I mean, probably they're calling the shots and, probably that's just, plausible deniability. I mean, they get someone to do the final act and they say, we didn't send him to do that, but they gave him all the information that probably they gave the orders too. They're just covering that up.
And is that the same organization as the GUR or something, where are they the ones who were also assassinating or persecuting people inside Western Ukraine that were of opposition parties? I mean, one of the things we've talked about in the past is Zelensky basically outlawing political competition internally.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they've set up a totalitarian apparatus since the Maidan coup of 2014, and Zelensky, used the wartime measures to ban 12 opposition parties, and a lot of their leaders, have been harassed, forced into exile. Many of them have been kidnapped and jailed. And I think those jails are, known for torture and brutal conditions. So there's huge numbers of political prisoners. And the SBU and GRU. I think GUR is the military wing. So I think they're more involved in East Ukraine and Russia. And SBU would be more involved in Western Ukraine. I know all the left-wing parties have been banned, including the Socialist and Communist Party. And you can contrast that with Russia. I mean, the Communist Party is the leading opposition party in Russia, and the media fixates with supposedly how unfree Russia is. And there certainly are authoritarian features, but their Communist Party is legal, whereas Ukraine, it's illegal, and all the communists are in jail, and socialists, and any party that's considered pro-Russian has been banned. And there are huge number of political prisoners. So, you wonder why, as you were saying before about the human rights industry, their hypocrisy is that they're not providing reports about the huge political repression going on in Ukraine.
Well, there's a few things also that came out of the article. One is that this is basically laying the groundwork, or it seemed to me, and you said it too, it's fashioning a new Mossad.
Yeah.
They're actually going into foreign countries and assassinating people on foreign soil.
Because they're doing that in Russia. And, it warns that they may be doing that in other countries as well. Who knows if they're going to hunt them down somewhere else, that may be the next step. I mean, they have this Murat Barrett's website, and that's the other thing, how brazen they are. It could be they're advertising this because they want people to fear them. So, and they have this website, and it says it's a CIA website. So, and those are people on the kill, it's a death list. And, traditionally, like under Phoenix, what the CIA did was they set up these blacklists, and they helped, to identify the people, and then they helped ultimately to track them down. Now they're openly publicizing the blacklist online, and it's a kind of, they're issuing a threat. and they've carried it out. I mean, Dugina was on the blacklist, and she was assassinated. And, you know, if you go on that Mrevert's website, they have the blacklist, and some people are crossed off.
Oh,
those
my
are people
gosh.
Killed. And a lot of them are journalists, you know, Russian journalists.
Yeah, weren't there charges brought? She was a journalist. I mean, that's just not, it's just not legal. And if there's any...
I know, murdering a journalist.
Yes, on foreign soil.
Poor black. And, you know, there was a propaganda campaign to depict Alexander Dugin as a fascist writer. And that was not true. You know, that might be how legitimize it, that, oh, he's a fascist.
I never looked into him, but I tried to, and I noticed a lot of that kind of...
I read two of his books, and I asked some Russians about it. And he's not... In fact, the first book I read, I found on the open library, although I had read one of his books when I was writing my book, The Russians Are Coming Again. So when I heard him reference as a fascism... And I, as a fascist, and even there are some people I knew who were like in anti-war type circles would say, oh, he's a fascist. I was like shaking my head because the book I had read by him advocated for a Central Asian Union. And it was like anti-imperial. It was like the Central Asian countries should unify, you know, to strengthen their economies, to strengthen them against the West. And it was critical of U.S. foreign policy and like Western imperialism. And then another book I read by him, he repudiated fascism like very early in the book, and he developed his own hybrid philosophy. But it was just a propaganda campaign, to try and legitimate, assassinating him and or his daughter. And you're right; it should generate outrage worldwide, and the culprits. Should be identified and put on trial. And the government, I mean, it's an outlaw government that would support overtly murdering journalists. But you don't have that outcry in the West. I think the propaganda campaign was effective. And people are not very well informed about the Ukraine conflict.
No.
I think they're better informed and outraged about the Israeli conflict on the Palestinians. But they don't have any empathy for the people of Eastern Ukraine who have suffered as much as the Gazans. There's no outcry about, for 9 years, they've been suffering under terrible bombardment and attack from Ukraine.
So many civilians
died. There was
no
solidarity with them. You know, you have all these Palestine solidarity groups, but you have no, and people who are on the left are involved in protests and stuff against what Israel's doing or expressing their outrage on Facebook. But I never saw very few, except people who are living in Russia and a small number of well-informed people who expressed any solidarity for the people of Eastern Ukraine and the atrocities that the Ukrainians backed by the U.S. perpetrated on them for 9 years, continuing today. And these assassinations, yeah.
I feel like conflict around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is being allowed to become more robust and out in the open, whereas, like, we don't have to talk about that, but it definitely smacks of all of a sudden the Palestinian side has a voice, which previously, after 9/11, they didn't. You know, like, there's something going on here that's a little different. And I feel like with Ukraine, it's very clear, like, they're not using it for a dialectic. They actually just want to win that, put it to rest, and square Russia away, which I don't think they're going to do. But another thing in the article was that they, and I don't know if it's true or not, but that the Ukrainian GUR, whatever, maybe it's the other one, I think it's the GUR, actually got drones as far as Moscow, which points out why Ukraine being a part of NATO is such an existential threat to Russia. And they're completely valid in worrying about that.
Oh yeah, and this is very dangerous. Yeah, I think at one point they even hit the Kremlin with an attack, and they've been very brazen in taking these attacks directly into Moscow and even attacking the Kremlin. And they have these drone capabilities. And I mean, this is particularly, and the point I made at the end is that, you know, this is as bad as things like the Phoenix program in Vietnam, but it's even more dangerous because this war is being taken into Russia itself, a nuclear armed power. It's threatening a world war and potential nuclear war. So it's really very, very dangerous and reckless. And I don't know why Americans put up with this. I mean, this is just a extremely reckless
yes.
foreign policy to
extremely.
Antagonize the Russians in this way and take a war into their homeland
yeah.
as such a major power.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Well, I think they were anti. There was something I read from, I think, 2019 on the RAND Corporation website about how they were seriously considering the option of drawing Russia into a real live conflict in Ukraine, kind of like the whole Afghanistan thing, and just try to get them bogged down with that, and that they were going to start with Belarus, go in there and try to bribe the president of Belarus. And if he went for it, that would be great. And if he didn't, like, demonize him and try to get him ousted. Like, it was a really comprehensive suggestion or whatever plan that that was an option. It's probably still on the RAND Corporation website, but it was 2019, and it said, you know, one way that we can lure Russia into this conflict is to continue to press for Ukraine, and I don't know if it was Georgia or somebody else, to get into NATO, which Russia could not tolerate, and that would be the perfect way to get them in. So I think that their provocation, which was the actual provocation in the, like, fall, whatever it was, right before the Russian action on February 24th, I guess it was. But prior to that, a couple of months prior to that, they really ramped up the NATO rhetoric of getting those people to join. And it seemed to me completely consistent with the plan to, you know, and it's reckless, but they're doing it. They want to do it.
Yeah, they want a war. And that's, I mean, war should be a last resort. You know, war is so horrible and kills so many innocent people and diverts our resources into just violence. So, I mean, it should be the last resort. You know, if your country's under threat of attack, then you have to defend yourself
right.
at last resort. But to go out like these documents, as you and I've read them too, and it showed they're just provoking conflicts when there was no conflict at all. And that's just pure aggression. And the reason is just like a geopolitical scheme to try and weaken your adversary by creating a major conflict, but you're threatening in the process a world war, and you can destroy your own country in the process. So
we're so insulated from really understanding what that means to just have innocent. I don't know a single innocent person who was killed on U.S. soil for their political views. Like, I don't know anyone personally, but, you know, whatever. 14,000 people were killed in the East Ukraine. I just, you know, it's something that we just don't understand. We value innocent life so highly, and I don't know why we think that we're above, you know, that we deserve it and other people don't because they're poor or whatever. And I think that JFK's speech at American University, which I believe is what actually was the last straw that got him killed, I think he was alluding to the fact that he realized, like, the CIA was in Africa creating tribal conflicts where there wasn't any, creating all these opportunities for war where, and I think that's why he said, I want a pax for all time, not a pax Americana, but a real peace for all people for all time, that he knew it was possible. And we were actually generating the conflict because that was our lifeblood, you know, whatever war is the health of the state. So it just, these things just are not changing. And yet generation after generation, people don't learn those lessons. So another, I didn't actually give you a heads up that I was going to refer to this a little bit, but another article that you wrote recently on covertactionmagazine.com was, is it magazine.com? What's the URL there? It's fully covertactionmagazine.com. So that, you know, Biden is talking about this, like, massive amount of money that he wants to, you know, contribute to the Ukraine and other wars. And $106 billion budget request to Congress for Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, Taiwan, and the U.S. border, $60 billion of which would go for military assistance to Ukraine. I mean, I remember when we were horrified that $30 billion went to Ukraine and then another $30 billion went to Ukraine. Now it's just $60 billion. It's just, you know, in a package. Let's keep sending it. What are they even... I mean, is that just a way to put... The $60 billion. I mean, the original scandal, like the Burisma scandal, which I was looking into with Kolomoisky, who was Zelensky's boss, with Kerry, with Biden, with Hunter Biden on that thing, that I thought really ultimately was about a $1 billion IMF loan that got funneled through all these guys' entities, maybe several billion through Privat Bank, which was Kolomoisky's bank. But now we're talking $60 billion. What are they? I mean, I feel like that this has to be the biggest corruption scheme ever. I mean, I really feel like Ukraine was potentially one of the most corrupt countries, you know, that I've ever heard of. And here they are continuing to funnel money into there.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of money. You know, at the bottom of the article, you know, discusses some of the, imagine if that money was used constructively. You know, the homeless problem could be ended, you know.
Right.
And, you know, last year I was at the Rage Against the War Machine rally. And Jimmy Dore was one of the keynote speakers, and that was part of his comedic routine. He's like, and he was talking about $100 billion last year, so it's another $100 billion this year, every year. And he was saying, with that money, we could cure cancer, we could end homelessness, put all the homeless back on the street, and then end it again. You know, shelter and job. And he's making jokes about it, but I mean, it was sad. And he said, I mean, at the end, I mean, yeah, it's kind of funny the way I'm framing it, but this is really sad. I mean, and that money is just going toward destruction. I mean, the Ukrainian army is not advancing. The reports I was reading, it's just like death on the Eastern Front. You know, the soldiers who are being sent to the front line, they know that 7 out of 10 member of their platoon is not going to make it. And they're in a living hell. And I mean, this could have ended a long time ago. You know, they had the Minsk framework that I think discussed on this show before.
Yes.
Was a reasonable framework, at least temporarily solve the problem and grant some, you know, autonomy to the eastern Ukrainian provinces. So this money is just give the Ukrainian the confidence that they don't have to negotiate, but they're sending their own soldiers to a death mill, and they're all dying. I mean, another report said that they're having to recruit people well into their 40s into the Ukrainian army because so many young people have either fled the country or are dead. So who is this benefiting?
I mean, right.
And this is money that could be used. I mean, they're urgent social problem in the United States. They, you know, go to any American city and there are all these homeless people. And I mean, they need some help, you know, maybe, you know, some of these people have serious problem, but a good number, if you give them some shelter and some hope, you know, some training that they can get a job, some investment in them, and they'll turn their life around. At least half of them probably could. So
you don't even have to put it in those simple terms. We actually have all the, I'm sure, mostly hidden psychological and sociological research. I'm confident they know exactly what they're doing. They're creating these problems. They, meaning the corpo governmental continuum, whatever, the CIA or Facebook, which is the CIA front, basically, like they create the, let's take an example, COVID policy. So if you want to say who are they, I would say the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Johns Hopkins. They created this worldwide COVID policy, which absolutely predictably, because I predicted it and said a lot of other people, would result in massive mental health issues for particularly adolescents. That's what I was focused on at the time. And now they have this massive mental health crisis and they have a lot of ready-made solutions that they can build their industries around. Same thing with drugs. I mean, the drug problem, yes, you could take the Singapore approach and just kill all the drug dealers. I'm not suggesting that. But I think you can trace fentanyl from, like, I think it was 2014 or 2018, there was some point where it just started. It just started. My sister died of a fentanyl, an accidental fentanyl overdose. Like it's in stuff that it didn't used to be in. And I feel like these problems are intentional, that if Jimmy Dore, your article, whatever, says like you have $100 billion, this is what you could do with it. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that our government and the politicians in it do not want to solve these problems. And if you look at how much we spend, that I would say surplus taxation is like probably approaching $10 trillion, maybe $7, $8 trillion, where they, if you stopped putting it into Social Security or Medicare, or even public education, if you took that money and divided it among the lower half of the population, 150 million people, every single person would get a $35,000 tax-free check every year. And I'm not saying we should do that. I'm just trying to get people's minds around how much money we are spending in the name of fiscal or physical security that is failing. And if you just converted that into like, okay, how much should it cost for one person to be able to live? $35,000 for every man, woman, and children below the 50% mark is more than enough to solve every single problem. And they're not doing it because they don't want to, in my opinion. And this is just another way of getting money out to their cronies and to create problems that will keep this machine going. I mean, that's nothing new in what I just said, but just every once in a while, I just feel like you have to think about the reality of this situation. It's mostly corruption. We can say there's a big picture, the devil is at work or whatever, but it's just mostly, in my opinion, like a venal corruption.
I would agree, yeah. And it's just
sorry for ranting.
Military contractors and fat cats. And yeah, that's what Robert Kennedy had a quote I read where he said something to that effect, that this is just a boondoggle, Ukraine, he was referring to, for Raytheon, you know, Boeing.
Right.
And then above them are these Wall Street firms like BlackRock and Vanguard that own them or invest in the stocks, and they're the big winners, and everybody else is a loser. And they want these wars to keep going on. They want to grind Russia into a quagmire so the war keeps going. And, you know, now they appointed Penny Pritzker to head the reconstruction.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And he's going to bring in all these corporations, are going to make more money rebuilding, you know, Ukrainian cities. And the contracts will go to American companies.
This is another article you wrote. Biden appoints billionaire from CIA mafia-linked family to oversee exploitation of Ukraine's economy by multinational corporations. I mean, that is an old story, too. I believe Libya is probably a good example of that.
Yeah, or Iraq, Afghanistan.
Yes, yeah. Yes, of course, yes.
Yeah, and it's just a business, exactly.
Even the Balkans.
They deliberately want to destroy countries and then give their friends the money to rebuild it. And who cares about all those lives who were destroyed?
Yeah, like water plants and schools and hospitals were bombed in Libya. And I remember thinking, are they that stupid? And then I realized they just go in and rebuild them. And it's just crazy. Then you wrote another article, which I'd love to talk to you about right now. American political history might have turned out differently if a Louisiana congressman's plane hadn't mysteriously vanished out of thin air 51 years ago. And what really caught my eye about this article is the last person to see him alive, basically, who did not get on that plane, was none other than Bill Clinton, the subject of your upcoming book. So this is Hale Boggs you're talking about. Tell me the story.
Well, and that's a fodder for conspiracy theory. I don't know if Clinton, I don't think in this case Clinton really had anything to do with it. He was very young, but it was just a coincidence, maybe. But Boggs was.
Possible that they knew that they had a profile of this guy as a sociopath, whatever. I always think that they identify some of these created persons very young. And if they knew, you know, if they said, all right, this is somebody who might see something, but we're pretty sure that if he does, we can get him to keep his mouth shut. You know, like I just think sometimes they put these people in the position, they don't know what they're doing, they don't have any real role, but they're the ones who know. Like I think Kamala Harris, it's like she knows where the bodies are buried. Like she's just being groomed to be one of these people who is always in a position of like, we'll never tell. I don't know.
Well, that's true of Clinton. Actually, by that point, he was already recruited into the CIA because he was recruited either at Georgetown or when he was a student at Oxford University and his roommate was.
He was a Rhodes Scholar. Yeah, his great what?
Although his roommate was Strobe Talbot, who was a Russia hand, and the two of them went on a trip to Russia to smuggle the memoirs of Nikita Khrushchev and material from Khrushchev, because Khrushchev had denounced Stalin. So that was valuable for the U.S. in the Cold War to publicize Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin. So that was their mission. And Talbot knew Russian, and he later worked for Time magazine, and he translated Khrushchev's memoirs into English. And so Clinton was with the CIA, so, and that would fit in that he may have had something, you know, had some role in the Boggs operation, because, yeah, the CIA very likely was behind Boggs' murder, because Boggs was a member of the Warren, he was a dissenting member of the Warren Commission, who signed off on the Warren Commission, but he was speaking with Jim Garrison, the, and that's how, you know, Jim Garrison was the New Orleans attorney who prosecuted Clay Shaw for his involvement in the conspiracy to murder JFK. And he was, you know, publicizing that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, that the CIA was very likely involved, that possibly Lyndon Johnson was involved. And Boggs had been the one feeding him a lot of information. And Boggs had become very critical and skeptical of the Warren Commission report. And he was slated to be the next Speaker of the House. And with the Watergate scandal, he could have potentially become a president, or he could have been the candidate in 76 instead of Jimmy Carter. Or with Watergate, if Nixon and Agnew had gone out together, the Speaker of the House becomes the president. So there's even a chance he could have become president in the early 70s or the Democratic Party nominee. And he was going to reopen the Warren Commission and the investigation into JFK's assassination. That was only about 10 years after.
Right.
And probably also into Robert Kennedy's assassination. So that would be the motive behind his assassination. And he was also starting to criticize the FBI. And he criticized Hoover for presenting misinformation to the Warren Commission. And he also spoke out in Congress how Hoover was, they harassed, you know, some book authors who had written some pioneering books investigating the Kennedy assassination, and those authors were harassed in different ways, and Boggs said that was un-American, and he was warning about a growing police state and totalitarianism. So there were some powerful people who wanted him gone, and the FBI and the CIA, and then he took a plane, and his plane crashed in Alaska. It was with another congressman, Nick Begich. And yeah, Begich's son has given some public interviews, and he said, you know, talk about a real-life conspiracy, as he went into all the details. And there was a lot of, you know, if you look into the crash, it was very suspicious. They didn't report it correctly when it happened, and they were hiding information. And then some mafia elements who had connection with the CIA later admitted that they planted a bomb. So it's pretty well established that it was a murder of Boggs and Nick Begich.
It's established that they plant. Can you elaborate on the bomb thing?
From my recollection, these mafia guys admitted, I guess.
Oh, right, right, yeah. Okay,
question the credibility, but I know it's, if you have somebody confessing to the crime, it's obviously very significant. So
yes, right. I'm looking at this article on your website, and I see that there's an ad for Garrison, a magazine, which I assume is named after Jim Garrison.
Yes, that's named after Jim Garrison.
Yeah, he was the only person who ever prosecuted anyone in the JFK assassination.
Yeah, and he's the basis for Oliver Stone's film. You know, he's the hero in Oliver Stone's film, right. JFK.
Right.
And he's a compelling historical figure. But yeah, Boggs was the one who tipped him off that the Warren Commission was corrupt and was supplying him with information about the CIA's role and others in the conspiracy, including Lyndon Johnson.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was in this Hal Boggs article that you wrote, it was extremely disturbing to me that they got credible information that two of the four people on the plane had survived, and that was just not fully followed up on, or there's no evidence of it being followed up on. I mean, that's just, that just makes me sick.
Yeah, there's exactly, they're all kind of odd things, and there was never a thorough investigation or at least publicly disclosed information that offered a clear explanation of what might have happened. And, you know, when it's clear they're hiding information, you start to become really suspicious. And then later, there are these admissions by these mafia guys about planting a bomb. So
right. Just the idea that those people were starving and freezing to death out in the mountains in Alaska is just so inhumane. But the fact, you know, it's weird because I had... The name sounds familiar, but I feel like there are other famous bogs, like Wade Boggs and stuff. So Hale Boggs, I just wasn't really familiar with it, but that he was actually on the Warren Commission and then, you know, died mysteriously not that long after. I mean, that's major. That definitely needs to be on the short list of likely political assassinations.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think many people would recognize his name today, but that, I guess, by design, they made sure that he wouldn't become very well known. It would be forgotten. And he was, you know, I mean, there's so many, if you look into the Kennedy assassination, there's so many people who died mysteriously who were in the know about the Kennedy assassination. So he's one of them, and he's very prominent at the time. He was a very prominent political figure who was a potential future president, or at least certainly would have been the Speaker of the House, where he could use that platform. I mean, they did have the House Committee on Assassination was convened in the late 70s following the Church Committee. That probably would have been convened much earlier if he was the Speaker of the House. And maybe would have probed deeper into the CIA. And maybe he would have helped to build momentum for reopening the investigation
right.
At large, and criminal prosecutions extending beyond what Garrison had started with Clay Shaw.
I mean, there would
more
be.
Of a bit player. Clay Shaw was more of a bit player.
Right.
And there were much bigger fish to fry. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so I feel like the theory to beat is that this guy was assassinated. That's just awful. And they had such a competent pilot and it was safe to fly. There was one other article. I feel like I keep pulling things out of your past that you may not have refreshed your memory on, but I'm sure you can give us a little. I wanted to read a passage or two from the article you wrote. U.S. taxpayers are funding their own conditioning for a war that would entail national suicide. And I just want, you know, it opens with the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, a CIA cutout, provided $5 million in grants to anti-Chinese government groups to try to destabilize China and spread propaganda to isolate it while building opposition to its government. That was in 2021. I've gotten emails from people who don't really, they think the National Endowment for Democracy is good. And one reason that people will think that, I think, is that it was established during the Reagan administration. And a lot of people don't realize that either, whether he was, you know, deep state or a lot of things happened, like just look at the debt during his time. Like it's, I loved Reagan. I mean, I cried when he was shot, but I just, I know that he did. I mean, the vaccine stuff all came from his era. So can you just explain what the National Endowment of Democracy is, or is supposed to be, or really is?
Sure, yeah. Well, it was founded in the early 80s. William Casey was a key figure in its founding. He was the CIA director under Ronald Reagan. And basically, it was to do overtly what the CIA had been doing covertly in the 60s and 70s. And that is to fund propaganda and to largely, you know, to demonize governments that the U.S. are considered enemies of the United States or geopolitical rivals like Russia and China, and to fund dissidents within those societies and fund, you know, opposition groups to the government and fund like media to promote like anti-Chinese Communist Party. For instance, like it will fund intellectuals in China who are against the Chinese Communist Party and intellectual journals and exiles who want to overthrow the Chinese government. And it sometimes will support minority groups who are persecuted, like in Russia or China or in South American countries. And like, yeah, in the 80s, it was funding like newspapers that were anti-Sandinista, like in Nicaragua, and anti-Soviet, you know, exiles on some of their writings. And like there are authors, like in the buildup to the Iraq War, they were funding Iraqi exiles who were like, against Saddam Hussein and broadcasting his human rights crimes, because that was used to mobilize public opinion to support the U.S. Overthrow of Saddam Hussein and military invasion. So, and it's used to support like color revolutions in like Eastern European country, like Ukraine or Georgia. They'll fund networks of sometimes youth who are agitating against the government, and they want to ultimately cause something like the Maidan uprising and coup of 2014 in Ukraine that was driven in part by young people. And you know, they will fund like social media so they can connect on social media. And some of the projects seem innocuous, and that they're, you know, they present it as though we're supporting human rights and democracy, but they're really an underlying goal of advancing U.S. power and targeting certain governments that defy U.S. interests.
They were openly involved in the Hong Kong protests.
Yeah, openly. Exactly. That would be an example. They're inciting, and some of the insurrections end up being very violent insurrections against the government, like in Ukraine. And, you know, they're really carrying out terrorist activity, often against legitimate governments that are either legitimate in the eyes of their people or even democratically elected governments, like in the case of Ukraine in 2014, was a legally elected government. So a lot of their activities,
yes,
may
right.
be illegal.
And the Chinese people I knew at the time that that was happening were just couldn't believe the stupidity of rocking the boat in Hong Kong, which had a better situation than they would have if China went in and changed stuff. Like, it's not like they were going to win independence. They were going to just get deeper and deeper into the fold, to the point where I almost thought it was a false flag operation by the Chinese to try to justify completely absorbing Hong Kong before that was scheduled. But once I saw the National Endowment of Democracy was involved, I realized that it was just a, you know, operation from the outside.
Yeah. And they promote the writing like Gene Sharp, who had like a blueprint for overthrowing governments. And some of the people they support, like in South America, they've supported some extreme factions who use violence and carry out terror. Like we were describing in Ukraine, there are elements in Latin America who've carried out those kind of activities as well with the goal of regime change.
There's a little passage here in your article, you know, it's in the section called Selling War with China. And it says, on September 6th, the War Industry Resisters Network supported a webinar on selling war with China that spotlighted the profiteering underlying the spread of anti-China propaganda. And the first speaker was Carl Zha, who runs a podcast about China and the Silk Road. And I just wanted to, I thought this was really illuminating of like I like when you spell out what's really going on. So I just want to read it directly. Zha says that the U.S. ruling class is divided between business elites who still want to access the China market and the Pentagon, which fears China's economic rise and challenge to the U.S. and wants to contain and isolate China. So this, I mean, I'm such a conspiracy theorist that it's hard for me to even like really identify competing factions. But what I think is probably the truth is that there are competing factions who do have like overarching aligned interests in that they don't actually want, you know, they don't want, for example, the international financial system to collapse. Like I've actually read that the reason his rise was tolerated is that they didn't actually fear that he would do something on a financial, you know, really high level financial scale. But so I thought that was interesting. I'm open to that theory. And then it goes on to say the Biden administration has sided with the latter, Pentagon, in pursuing a policy of military encirclement while trying to weaken China's semiconductor industry. I've done numerous shows, 45-minute shows, simply on like the Taiwan, like that these visits of Nancy Pelosi and other people went straight to Taiwan for some mysterious reason. And they all met with, for extended periods of time, the Taiwan Semiconductor Company, which had a very deep history, which I did expand. So I absolutely think targeting that in your article is absolutely right. China's semiconductor industry and to decouple America's economy from China's. And then the last thing I'll read, because it actually delineates the specific things the Biden administration has done, in your words, to further antagonize China by A, sending warships into the South China Sea and spy planes over the Taiwan Straits, which is under Chinese jurisdiction, B, expanding the U.S. military base network in the Philippines, C, fortifying the U.S. military alliance with South Korea and Japan, D, helping to transform Okinawa into a garrison state for war with China, E, sending nuclear-armed submarines and precision weapons to Australia aimed at China. I've read all of these things in the papers, it's not disputed. F, furthering military cooperation with India, G, turning Taiwan into a heavily armed, quote, porcupine that hosts U.S. Special Forces, and H, sending B-52 nuclear-armed bombers to Guam. These are all things that have actually happened. And, I mean, we're worried about war with Russia. This is a two-front war with Russia and China. I'm not fired up for that.
Yeah, and that's insanity. I mean, and what is the purpose? And, you know, like even the first dilemma you point out, I mean, even the business community was benefiting from the U.S. trade with China. And yeah, I mean, there were some, you know, exploitative aspect with these sweatshops and the like, but I mean, there are a lot of opportunities. So why are you pursuing? And, you know, a lot of the business community wanted to further a positive diplomatic relation so they can continue to make money with China and trade with China, which is a booming economy. And, you know, that presents a lot of opportunity. Unfortunately, I think the mentality of the ruling elite see that as a threat, you know, that China is growing economically, when actually there's opportunity for mutual benefit economically. But then you have these Pentagon interests that we've been discussing that just want war and that profit off war. And it's provoking this really insane strategy that the U.S. is planning for war with China, and they're already in a shadow war with Russia at the same time, and that's extremely dangerous. I mean,
I guess it could be as simple as the defense industry wants that the schism is between the defense industry and consumer industry, because I'm convinced, especially with regard to Russia, but maybe also China, I just haven't looked into it as much. I'm absolutely convinced that for self-serving reasons, Putin has wanted this entire time for decades to have Russia enter into the Western commercial fold, and that's just what he wanted. He wanted to keep Russia Russian, but have its economy basically Europeanized in its style, but, you know, trading freely and crossing that border in both directions. But I feel like after the Berlin Wall fell or whatever, the West just viewed this as a big new market, flooded that with their consumer goods, had the tax money like distributed to people to buy the stuff. And I think once they got on their feet and could actually compete, China too, they don't want to have to compete, or it's the defense industry alone that's driving this, what seems to be, dominant and dangerous direction.
Yeah, and it's really a destructive policy. I mean, it's just going to lead to, you know, violence. And I mean, yeah, I mean, there's so many opportunities for mutual benefit. And yeah, Putin, as you say, was really more pro-Western oriented leader. I mean, he was Boris Yeltsin's successor, who was not a Marxist. And the Chinese, you know, had shifted their economy under Deng Xiaoping and were more also, I mean, yes, it is a mixed market economy and a strong public, you know, a controlled aspect of their economy, but they had liberalized under Deng Xiaoping. And there's huge, you know, opportunities for American investors and business in China. And that was the long-held dream, you know, to access the China market. And they reached that dream. So why abandon the policy that Nixon had crafted? It shows how what Eisenhower warned about with the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
That leads to destruction of democracy and a complete warping of public policy in a very, very destructive way that's not beneficial to anybody except this narrow cliques that make huge profits. And their profits, I guess, are so obscene that they can't resist, and they keep going forward even to the point of threatening a self-destructive war.
Yes, and I do feel like the Eisenhower originally called it the military-industrial congressional complex, which kind of explains it all, that's how what will be the policy comes from there. So I think, you know, I try to figure out what the big picture is, and if it's as simple as defense industry wanting to profiteer, you know, at the expense of everything. I'm not super worried about violence here, but our standard of living is definitely going to suffer. It's already suffered. These weird COVID policies and supply chain interruptions, I feel, were absolutely some kind of paradigm shift to move us away from that integrated Chinese relationship. One thing that I want to keep my eye on, and if you ever hear anything about this, maybe I'll do a deep dive on it. I believe that the U.S. Navy basically patrols the entire Pacific Ocean. And if we didn't, our trade with China would be impossible without massive, you know, China would have to just pay for that themselves, which they may or may not do. And it would not be cost effective. I'm kind of just waiting for that to go backwards. I'll have to look into that. If anybody knows anything about it, let me know. All right. Well, I think I stepped over my boundaries by asking you about every single article you wrote in the past couple of weeks, but they were also interesting. And I just encourage people, I'll put them in the show notes, to read those. And I really look forward to the Clinton book. And yeah, what else you got?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's up to you. We've had a lot of good discussions.
Oh, yeah, we hit it all. So let's just direct people to your articles. Actually, I'll put them all in the show notes on monicasdeepdives.com, but you can go to covertactionmagazine.com. And if you like the first article that pops up today, I think is yours, Jeremy, click on Jeremy's name and all his articles will cascade down in front of you. And they're all worth reading. I just love the data dump I get when I talk to you, Jeremy. So next time, I hope, because I expected, you know, books getting published always push off a little bit. So it's pushed back. It was supposed to be October. But I'm hoping that the next time we talk, we can talk in depth about your new Clinton book. What's it called?
It's called Warmonger, How Clinton Shaped the U.S. Foreign Policy Trajectory from Bush to Biden. And yeah, it shows how a lot of these disastrous policy, like we've been describing, even China, because I think Clinton started to set in motion a more confrontational policy than had been in place from Nixon. And he started the ball rolling to what could be ultimately very devastating, ultimately for the U.S. economy, as you were alluding at the end, and also just dangerous for world peace and security when you have major powers threatening each other. It could lead to proxy wars or a full-fledged world war. And I think, you know, Clinton started on that path with China as well as Russia by antagonizing Russia, by expanding NATO, and also by imposing this shock therapy system that devastated Russia's economy on its transition from a communist system to a free market system. It was not done. You know, China was much smarter. They transitioned under Deng Xiaoping, you know, more on their own terms and in a gradual way. But in Russia, they just pushed this a massive sell-off of Russian state industry in a corrupt process with all kind of cronyism, and it led to an economic catastrophe. And so Clinton's Russia policy was a disaster, yeah.
I'm super eager to read about that if you go into that in the book. I've always wondered about that.
I do, yeah. I have chapters on Russia, on China and Southeast Asia, on the Balkan conflict, on Rwanda, because that was another case where they destroyed the conflict to make, like, their, you know, needed humanitarian intervention. But, you know, they were really supporting the side that did most of the killing and that invaded Congo. Like, Clinton was supporting Rwanda's invasion of Congo that killed millions of people and devastated Congo's economy. And they were trying to access the mineral wealth of the Congo. So there were a lot of corrupt thing that Clinton did. And, you know, the I think the reputation is low in some circles, but there are still place, you know, if you go in a lot of parts of the country, there's still veneration for the Clintons and respect for them when they've done all these terrible things. Going back to the time Bill was a governor of Arkansas. And yeah, it goes back to his early career. He was in league with the CIA from the time he was in college, and they were a deeply immoral power couple. And this book sheds light on that and sheds light on the deeper corruption in American politics that we need more pushback against.
Yeah, well, I'm super eager to read that and to talk to you about it, share it with the audience. Thank you, as always, Jeremy, for coming and spending your time with us. I know you're a busy guy. Thank you all for listening. This is Monica Perez, and you have been listening to Deep Dive.